You're tuned into Pacifica Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.5 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest, China Lake, and streaming universally at kpfk.org. Radio powered by you, the people.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Liberation stories. Building Narrative Power for 21st Century Social Movements is the first anthology created by and for social justice communicators. It's about how to construct the world we envision, telling stories that change the world. And we're joined today by co-editor Marzena Zukowska and contributor, Los Angeles contributor, Jessica Jewell. Marzena is an organizer, comm strategist, and the co-founder and co-director of the UK-based immigrant rights organization, POMAC. And Jessica is director of digital strategy at the Water Hub, and she started her career at Tree People, using stories to inspire grassroots and policy change. So that's a little bit about both of them, but today we want to talk about liberation stories. And Marzena, let's start with you. What was the inspiration for the book? How did this all come about?
Yeah, it's a great question, Lynn. And thank you so much for having us on the show. We have so much respect for the work that you do, very much in the lineage of building narrative power as well, in your role at KPFK. But, you know, the inspiration for the anthology actually came from my fellow co-editor, Chanel Matthews, and I really wanting to create the kind of resource that we wish that we had had when we were starting out in organizing and in communications work. Oftentimes when we do comms work, especially as activists and organizers, we're kind of thrown into it, right? We stumble into storytelling work because of necessity, right? Needing to tell the stories of our community members from a grassroots level in order to counter the public and dominant discourse. And, you know, at the time when we started working on this project about 6 years ago, you know, there was unfortunately a dearth of kind of really modern day case studies, really from the 21st century. We were still using this incredible book by Patrick Rinesborough and Doyle Canning called Reimagining Change. And some of the case studies from that book were dating back, you know, to the World Trade Organization protests, you know, in the Pacific Northwest. And we wanted something that offered really like both an analytical framework for narrative power building, but also, you know, took the biggest social movements of our time and like really analyzed what worked and what didn't. And from a very honest perspective. So, you know, that 6 year journey, you know, traversing multiple continents, looking at 24 years of contemporary movement history, working with 62 authors. Wow. I mean, certainly the thought crossed our minds of, you know, could we do this as a co-authored book, but it wouldn't be honest to the movements that we were a part of. You know, narrative power is built through a multiplicity of voices, and we very much wanted to honor that lineage in this book.
Amazing, 62 contributors. And yeah, it sounds like it's absolutely like you're walking your talk by the very way that you're constructing narratives from the grassroots. You're also telling these stories from the people who've actually done these campaigns. And Jessica, tell us about your particular chapter.
Thank you for asking. So our chapter, my co-author, Olivia Blocker, we collaborated on this piece that covered the arc of influence from celebrities to the modern day of online influencers, right? So my experience in my time in the work started, right, working with celebrities and doing physical ad unveilings or video PSAs that were so scripted into camera and rigid, or red carpet grip and grins. And now we have democratized information sharing and influence with the rise of social media. Of course, it every rose has its thorns. Nothing is perfect. So, you know, with that comes a proliferation of opportunity for mis and disinformation, social engineering. But with that comes this opportunity, right? As folks have been able to build their own platforms, it's beyond, say, a makeup influencer. Folks sometimes conflate influencers with folks that are just, you know, pushing product, but it means more than that. So the beginning of the chapter, we talk about how a case study with Princess Diana and how she was able to bring a lot of awareness to the AIDS epidemic, and how much the conversation and the narrative shifted, you know, after years of course, queer-led organizing. It still came into a more compassionate place into the public consciousness when she started to put her weight behind it. And then from there, we talk about the evolution of how Greta Thunberg, you know, with Fridays for Future, launched, you know, her platform on Twitter and grew it and grew it and grew it up to 2020, where we saw the explosion of short form video. And we saw folks, you know, from all over the world in their different communities building followings on TikTok and popularizing messages as we were all in our silos. But that's carried through, right? So what we talked about there is the Water Hub worked with some Indigenous organizers and folks across the country during the Line 3 oil pipeline fight. And we engaged folks in different niches, from a PhD soil scientist, and sent her out to the field on the front lines to do some recordings on for her YouTube channel, to a fashion influencer who, you know, focuses on sustainable fashion, doing short form video to raise awareness and drive signatures to help fight this oil pipeline that unfortunately still came to pass, but just, you know, a microcosmic look at what we can do to engage folks online for social change.
Yeah. And I love that you so clearly put into that chapter how each of these moments of storytelling, of building narrative power, did not sort of stand alone, that there had already been movement building and grassroots activism, you know, in sort of different forms, that this was kind of the framing built on top of that. Because so many times we have the sense that, oh, something just popped up out of nowhere, some famous person was suddenly inspired, you know, to have a conscience. And anyone who's done any organizing or been part of any movements is really aware of like how long that building takes to happen. That's your background, right, Majina?
Yes, absolutely. I think if I identify any way, it is organizer first and narrative practitioner second. But I think, you know, reflecting on what you said, Lynn, I think, you know, one of the things that we really wanted to do with this anthology is kind of subvert that dominant narrative of social movements, right? Which I think conveniently position social movements as, you know, the great orators, the heads of organizations, the founders, the leaders, right? That is kind of, let's just say, those in power want us to think that they're not made up of everyday people, mm-hmm. right? And that everyday people don't actually have the power to enact change. And that was what we wanted to show through this anthology, is that actually, you know, social movements have such a long lineage, and most of the chapters in some way, shape or form, just as Jess in Olivia's chapter does, reach back far into history to show that the movements of today, right, whether we're talking about the Me Too movement, you know, Black Lives Matter, the modern day movement for reparations, right, those go back to a much longer lineage. And keeping that in mind, and really incorporating it into those traditions, into our practices today, ensures that we're not repeating kind of the same mistakes or having to rebuild from the ground up, especially because the dominant narratives that we're currently up against in this country and globally with, you know, what we can call the probably the biggest resurgence of fascism since the 20th century, that's very much seeped in very old dominant narratives, right? Those aren't new stories. They're the old stories being kind of recycled over.
I think one of the other important points that I saw in a Q&A that you did brought up this question of there's no neutrality in mainstream media. And we have this illusion, or we're sold this illusion of objectivity. So I'd like both to talk a little bit about that. Jess, if you want to start.
I'll speak to, you know, especially when we're looking at the digital landscape, right? We have institutions like Turning Point USA, for example, who has an entire program dedicated to funding and incubating online voices and influencers so that they rise to power and grow their media platform. We have the right that has, you know, really developed an incredible backbone of infrastructure for their media ecosystem. And this is where folks are going to get their information. You know, social media is the number one source of news now for the first time, according to new research that was released a few months ago, overtaking TV for the first time. So if we're talking about neutrality, like where are people going to get their information? Who's owning these major flagship entities? Right. We see, you know, billionaires that are attending, you know, private dinners with Trump and going to inaugurations. These are the folks that are controlling information, and the publishers, you know, with Washington Post and beyond, you know. So we are living in a technocratic world, and it's very challenging to get vetted information. So I think it's important for us to meet people where they're at, give people vetted information to counter, you know, these really harmful narratives that are being saturated in what's considered neutral mainstream media oftentimes. So we have to adapt and also just be real that there really is no such thing as unbiased news. And just making sure that we are serving folks that are most impacted by harm around us all the time.
Absolutely. Marjana?
Yeah, just echoing everything that Jess said, what my reflections in that interview that you mentioned, Lynn, I was reminded of the work of, you know, fellow comrade Lewis Raven Wallace, who, I mean, this was back in 2016, 2017, ended up losing his job from NPR because of writing a Medium article that I think moved many of us at the time, as a trans journalist reporting under the first wave of Trump's first administration, the kind of I would say really enlightenment myth that if you don't operate from the default, right, the default identity, which unfortunately most institutions have been built around, which is white, cisgender, heterosexual, and male, then suddenly there's a conflict of interest. Or, you know, I think as many AFAB people have been told for a very long time, your emotions get in the way, right? Block your ability to see this objectively. I mean, we have an interview in the book with Tanya Kailani and Noura Erekat, both are incredible media makers and Palestinian journalists and activists. They had actually written a very different chapter that was reflecting on a different case study moment in the Movement for Palestine Liberation. And after October 7th happened, they actually pulled that chapter out and said, you know, all of, you know, decades of work in one moment had been undone, because suddenly newsrooms that were actually lifting up Palestinian voices for the first time started falling back on, you know, the kind of classic biases of, again, using passive voice to report on Palestinian deaths. They were, you know, the classic question of what about Hamas? And, you know, that bias was built into the media environment from the very beginning, you know. So it's a media environment that favors certain voices because of all of the reasons that Jess had already outlined. And, you know, and it doesn't, and I think sometimes people conflate for example, journalistic and media ethics with objectivity. Mm-hmm. You know, I think very much if you operate from a grassroots kind of narrative power perspective, you know, I remember working at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, you know, in a press strategist role. My role was very much to elevate the voices of our domestic worker members and leaders and make sure that we're creating more opportunities, more choices, more agency rather than less. And part of that job is letting people understand how this media apparatus works so they can make informed choices in how to share their stories. You know, so that kind of ethics work is very much part of the job.
We've been talking to editor and contributor to the new anthology called Liberation Stories, Building Narrative Power for 21st Century Social Movements. We've been talking to Marzena Zukowska and Jessica Jewell. The book has, 31 chapters where different progressive campaigns are taken apart. And I love that. It's that whole concept of showing how the sausage is made, but really, like, how did this happen? Which really kind of demystifies things. And you use the phrase narrative power. Can you just explain that a little bit for our listeners, like how you use that and what it means?
I guess to break down, you know, by narrative, we mean kind of collections of stories. Mm-hmm. So we understand that throughout our everyday lives, we hear various stories, we tell various stories, right? When you take all of those together, you start getting this kind of set of narratives that govern our day-to-day world, right? Narratives around, you know, in the US, for example, meritocracy, right? Or the myth of meritocracy, right? That if you just do X, Y, and Z thing, you will be able to make it. Or narratives around how healthcare functions, right? Or how our economic system works. So those narratives function every day to help us make meaning of the world. And then by power, we mean, you know, simply the ability to act, right, or to influence something. There are so many different forms of power that exist out there. We kind of consider narrative power to be one that is least often thought of, I think, because of the way that it functions in a very kind of invisible way a lot of the time versus, you know, political power, you can see it. Military power, you could see it, right? The kind of power over. So when, you know, the kind of definition that we like to use or that we have in the book is that, you know, narrative power is the ability to influence and shape what society deems acceptable, whose voices matter and are lifted up, what we consider to be common sense, right, in society. So that's kind of how we see narrative power, but it very much functions and intersects with every other type of power that's out there. But I think the crucial bit is that, you know, all stories have a sense of power, right? And those who kind of, you know, whether control corporate interests or the media or politics, right, have to tell a certain kind of story to legitimize themselves, right? So it's not just, we're not kept in line and we don't follow the rules simply because of sheer brute force, right, that holds us in position. It is also because of the stories that are underpinned by certain ideologies, right, that keep us operating a certain kind of way.
And Jessica, you've worked primarily in climate justice, the water justice world. How have you seen the storytelling shift in that world, you know, specifically like where we are now in terms of the current horrific political situation?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's really interesting, right? Because the environmental movement, there's no secret that it's been like highly elitist and inaccessible and very white-centric and very centered on credentialing and has a very high barrier to entry traditionally, right? So going back to the chapter with Greta Thunberg, that was one entry point and one inflection point where we started to see a subversion of, you know, recentering power around the knowledge that the youth have to contribute to a movement as, you know, folks that can advance solutions and aren't just infantilized, right? So the paternalistic frame started to shift. And we started to move a bit away from just being so focused on the technical and the science aspect of this, you know, expansive issue and seeing it become more intersectional, you know, at least in the public consciousness more, you know, with, you know, the No DAPL movement. Mm-hmm. That was a big media moment, right? Because it was the first time that we saw, at least in a big way in modern media, where we were seeing the experience of Indigenous folks leading a solution and a resistance around climate really platformed onto the main stage by way of, you know, as a means to an end. Sometimes we have these celebrities that intersect and engage and help amplify, but I believe we're seeing, you know, this movement and shift more and more into this being a lot of, having a lot of power behind it from youth. So for example, now we have LA Climate Week, we have New York Climate Week, and who are the organizers of these? Oftentimes it's folks that are younger that are leading these solutions. Now, mind you, it's not to imply that they are the panacea and that we should put the weight and burden upon younger folks that are, you know, experiencing a lot of psychological stress, but it's becoming a lot more inclusive. And I would say that it's very refreshing to see, as somebody who's been in this space for over 10 years, to see some self-criticism more happening about how can we really, like, who needs to be at the table? Who needs to be in these conversations? And I've seen coalitions become a lot more diverse. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some that have fallen because, you know, some failures about not listening and having hubris involved. But here we are, right? Now we're at this political moment where we have folks like Lee Zeldin leading the EPA, deregulating everything. We're having the endangerment finding at risk. We just heard a couple days ago that there's going to be, folks are not, you know, that big industry is not going to necessarily be required to report their emissions to the EPA, which is wild. So we're seeing more and more of deregulation. But in that moment, we have this opportunity, right? Because there's a lot of attention on this issue. I think that we're seeing more people who may have not been as engaged before becoming activated because they're seeing, you know, fundamental harms coming down their way. And it's only going to be more amplified, right, as our air and our water become unsafe to breathe and drink, which are, you know, fundamental human rights. And we're seeing, you know, we're tracking this in, like, we do media analysis of the Water Hub. And so we're regularly tracking narratives around water and sentiments around access, affordability, safety. And a lot of our movement partners that we serve are seeing a lot of interest in their communities of getting engaged around, you know, the human right to clean water. So I'm hopeful, though at the same time, we have quite a hill to climb. But yeah, it's very interesting because it's been a huge shift, too. I mean, I came from in a previous role working with a lot of white mommy bloggers to talk about the environment. And now the folks that I work with are almost entirely, you know, folks of color, younger people, people who have, you know, completely different lenses. They're not promoting this clean living, you know, very harmful, like, lifestyle, you know, portrayal of perfectionism, but more about justice for communities and solutions and the right to thrive. So I've seen it change quite a bit over time, but it's a mixed bag right now. I'm going to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's really mixed.
Yeah, it's a super challenging time, to say the least. So I love how you described that shift from the mommy bloggers. Marjana, tell us a little bit, if you can. I know you have 32 chapters, but for our listeners, to just give them a taste of what are some of the movements connected to some of the chapters that, oh, you're holding the book up, that you're... that you can just give us a few highlights of what to expect in the book.
Yeah, I mean, so many. maybe I could give a little bit of a, I'll give a story arc to it, right? So we start at the turn of the century, mm-hmm. and the kind of moment that we found has been most profound in affecting, you know, the environment in which social movements have been operating over the last 24 years has been the war on terror. So we start out with, 2001, and then later the invasion of Iraq, and talking about the impact that the war on terror narrative infrastructure, you know, what does it mean to wage war on a metaphor, on an ideology, and what happens to the kind of slippery boundaries of this never-ending war that kind of goes on forever, and that, you know, impacts not only communities abroad where the U.S. has committed violence and atrocities, but also communities domestically in the U.S., right? It is no surprise right now that, you know, with Trump deploying the National Guard in cities across the country, that is a direct outgrowth in lineage of the war on terror and the way police have been militarized as well. So that's kind of where we start our story. And then we end actually with that interview that I mentioned before with Tanya Nora on the Palestine Liberation Movement. So it's very contemporary kind of way to bookend things. You know, the book is divided, I think, into 6 or 7 different sections. You know, forgive me, after working on this labor of love for 6 years, a lot starts to meddle in your head, but we've got, you know, everything from the Black Lives Matter movement. Chanel Matthews, who's the co-editor, does this incredible job of really analyzing the 2020 uprisings and specifically the defund the police slogan and the direct abolitionist and Black radical tradition roots. We've got in there an analysis of the Me Too movement. So also kind of going back to, they go back pretty far into, like, you know, earlier Supreme Court moments as well, with, you know, with Clarence Thomas, for example, Anita Hill, and then tracing that lineage all the way to the Women's March. One of our favorite chapters by Catherine Olenberger and Dorian Warren kind of compares the impact of the Occupy movement, you know, a movement against wealth inequality that very much shaped future ones, right? You'll find mentions of Occupy both in the Me Too chapter, as well as the Black Lives Matter one. But they compare Occupy with the Fight for 15 and how in many ways Occupy opened up the Overton window and this ability for policy on economics to look very differently, but that ultimately the Occupy movement fizzled out, and where they stopped, the Fight for 15 with these very concrete demands was able to kind of pick up the baton, so to speak. And they recall that back in the day, it was called Fight for 15 and a union, and also highlight kind of the compromises that movements have to make, you know, to gain this kind of political acceptance. So I would say there's a little bit of everything for everyone. So if you've ever been curious about any kind of issue, I'm certain that you will find mention of it in this book.
I love that also, that it's part of the lineage story is pointing out that movements that may be framed, you know, by mainstream or looking backwards as having quote unquote failed, as you point out, might in fact be just building a foundation for what's going to come next, which I think is a really important reframing. So tell us a little bit about RADCOM, this Radical Communicators Network, and how that inspired the book. I had never heard of it before. I was like, what is this? I need to know more. And also, I know that RADCOM runs a 12-week seminar on narrative power, which uses liberation stories as the text. So tell our listeners all about that as well.
Yeah, so the Radical Communicators Network was founded by co-editor Chanel Matthews back in 2016. And it started, you know, back in the day, we were still organizing on Facebook. So Chanel put out a post on Facebook right after Trump got elected, you know, literally within like 24 or 48 hours, with kind of a provocation of, you know, what is our role in this moment as people doing communications work, people doing narrative work, recognizing that our stories have failed. You know, and it was just such a massive reckoning for the country. You know, I was working at the National Domestic Workers Alliance at the time, and I was watching the election results come in, and I was supposed to have written 2 press statements, one in the case that Trump wins and one in the case that Hillary wins. And I hadn't written the Trump one because I just, no one within the organization, no matter how much scenario planning we did, had believed that Trump would win that night. So, you know, Chanel put that call out and, you know, I think 100 of us showed up to that very first Zoom meeting. And that's kind of how the Radical Communicators Network was born. It was very in line with movements. Communications workers were the base, or, you know, organizers who were kind of thrust into these roles. And it started out very much with, you know, us kind of organically forming different working groups. So working groups around, you know, okay, how's the media now functioning under Trump? What do we need to know? What are opportunities within pop culture? How can we all ramp up our own political education, right? So there were reading groups that were formed. And slowly, kind of by word of mouth, the network started to grow. And the idea always was that it would be this community of practice. And I will say, you know, currently we're probably migrating the membership model at some point, but, you know, currently it exists on Google Groups as a listserv with, I think we're now close to 4,000 or 5,000 wow. people. And because it's been such a vetted community, I've been amazed at how well moderated the space is and how self-moderated the space has been. And I think that's a testament really to people wanting a space for learning and emphasizing that that's what it is. And so the Radical Communicators Network is listed as one of the co-editors of the anthology, because a good number of the contributors who are featured are part of RadComs, and also because this book wouldn't have been possible without this network forming. You asked about Rad School. So we recognize that Liberation Stories is a text that will quickly become dated, you know, in a way. We hope that these case studies will inspire people for a long time to come, but it is one kind of contribution in a series of many. And we've always hoped and kind of now wish that all of the contributors, ones like Jessica, will consider writing their own books mm-hmm. because each of those chapters can really be unpacked into a full volume. But we wanted and want Liberation Stories to be in conversation with contemporary moments, with things that are happening, and also with historical texts. So we designed Rad School, originally called the Narrative Power Curriculum, as kind of a space where, you know, Liberation Stories forms the foundation, but we are able to kind of learn through it together. The introduction to Liberation Stories proposes what we call a narrative power framework. So Chanel and I have been firm believers that, you know, a framework, whether it's like, you know, intersectionality or queer theory or dialectics, is a useful way to kind of get a baseline. You know, if we're all operating from the same framework, we could at least have a way of measuring our work against each other, the success of our movements and of our campaigns. So we wanted to propose a framework in there that kind of pulls in a lot of elements that we have found useful in analyzing our work, and then a few others like traditions and principles that we find to be instrumental to the success of movements. You know, principles forming the guardrails, traditions being that lineage that we come from. So, you know, the curriculum Rad School very much looks at the narrative power framework and kind of teaches it throughout as well. And you could learn more about it at liberationstories.com/radschool. And we are kind of accepting applications and interest on an ongoing basis. And unfortunately, we had to postpone the fall curriculum, but we'll be picking back up in the spring.
So folks can go to liberationstories.com, and it's a link in there. Jessica, what was your experience coming into RadComs?
I joined the Radical Communicators community in 2020, actually. So it was a pretty wild time. It was, I'd say it was right around when the pandemic was starting to pick up, and it came at just the perfect time. I was just thinking about how, as we go, right, and retreat and had to stay inside, less opportunity for networking, my world just opened up. It somehow became bigger when I joined this network, right? The irony of that. And I've been a pretty active member since. I've attended trainings, everyone is incredibly responsive. There's folks from all over the world and very generous with their knowledge. It is a community that's very communicative all day long. People asking for message guidance or asking simple, you know, questions of needing tips of like what reporters to approach. It's a very generous community of people who are very smart and, you know, thoughtful in the resources that they impart with each other. And I came actually in person for the first time with everybody in Long Beach about 2 or 3 years ago at this point. There was a convening and it just, you know, further strengthened those bonds. And I think as many of us, not all of us, some of us do a lot of cross movement work or, you know, from role to role, move into different spaces. But there's some of us, such as myself, that, you know, I've been steeped in the environmental and the climate justice space for a decade. It's incredibly refreshing and makes me a better movement worker and ally when I'm in community with folks who are working on all these issues that are in parallel and complement and intersect each other, because we can learn from each other. We, you know, we have different strategies that we may be tapping from, you know, the Free Palestine movement that we can employ over here and vice versa and share our learnings, our data, our message guidance, all of that. I think it only helps strengthen our, you know, narrative ecosystems, because as we know, everything touches each other. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't do this work in isolation. If we are, we're failing. We need to be doing this work alongside each other. So that was a pivotal moment. And then what got together in New Orleans this year in May. And that's where we did the kickoff for the book to celebrate it. And, you know, people from the network converged and we just shared incredible case studies. Marjana shared on stage with people from all over the world working on different, you know, anti-fascist narrative interventions. That was an amazing talk. Learned from people who were doing organizing in Louisiana that were able to get some very harmful ballot measures struck down against all odds, sharing what their creative interventions were. And it's just the best community. I cannot underline that enough. Like, I just feel in awe that I get to be part of this network.
Marjana, can you just give us the website again where folks can find the book, find out more about the book, and get the book right away, obviously?
Yeah, definitely. That will be liberationstories.com. And we highly encourage folks to get the book either, well, first off, from your local radical independent feminist bookshop. Mm-hmm. That would be great. Black-owned bookshops. We did a book tour this summer where we were speaking alongside many of the authors across really amazing independent bookstores. Apart from that, on the New Press website, our publisher, and bookshop.org, which is also a really great kind of nonprofit mm-hmm. distributor. Please do not get it off of Amazon.
Well, we've been talking to editor and contributor to the new anthology called Liberation Stories, Building Narrative Power for 21st Century Social Movements. We've been talking to Marjana Zukowska and Jessica Jewell. And thank you both so much for joining us and talking about Liberation Stories.
Welcome to Democracy Now.
You're not hearing double. Starting Monday, October 20th, Democracy Now! Airs twice daily on KPFK, 7 to 8 a.m. Monday through Friday, plus 10 a.m. Monday through Thursday. Morning person or not, we've got you covered. KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and streaming on kpfk.org.
Trump 2.0's crackdown on immigration has been in the news pretty constantly since January, and it's carried out under the auspices of the Department of Homeland Security, which includes Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. The department was created in the aftermath of 9/11 and radically reshaped immigration enforcement in the United States in ways that we still see today. In light of all this, we wanted to bring you a story that touches on one person's experience of being caught in the anti-Muslim fervor after 9/11, how she became an organizer advocating for the rights of undocumented people, and what lessons that can teach us about avoiding burnout and doing social justice work so we can make it sustainable. This next piece comes to us by way of rework from the UCLA Labor Center.
It took me years to start thinking about walking away from politics. I was really driven by my personal connection to the work. I had an opportunity to take some downtime that I had never had in my life, and I took basically 6 months off to think about what I wanted to do next that wasn't working on politics and working on immigration because I was so exhausted. I think there's a lot of people who had worked in progressive activism for years who basically left around the time of the Biden administration because we were burnt out and exhausted.
I feel like we hear more and more about burnout. We're hearing more about rising anxiety. We are seeing athletes and celebrities take breaks for mental health. So how do we want to think about burnout, anxiety, the emotional and mental load when you're working in the social justice sector, especially when you have a personal connection to what you're fighting for? I'm Veena Humpapour, and I'm joined today by my friend George Chacon, who's deputy director of the Dream Resource Center. Thanks for co-hosting with me today, George.
It is my pleasure, Veena. Thank you so much for inviting me to your space, and I just can't wait to talk a little bit more about our guest.
So in today's episode, we speak with Annie Athar about her pathway into immigrant rights work and later into climate justice work.
These days, Annie lives in the Bay Area, but she's originally from Pakistan.
When I was 2 years old, my family decided to move to the United States. We are part of a religious community in Pakistan called Ahmadi Muslims, and Ahmadis are highly persecuted and experience a lot of violence and discrimination.
Annie's family moved around quite a bit in the 90s, and eventually when she was 7 years old, they settled down in a suburb of Houston.
I grew up in a neighborhood in southwest Houston called Alief. It's a common pit stop for recent immigrants. And there were also families who'd lived there for a long time that were Black and Latino. When I was in, I think, the third or fourth grade, we had this day where the school was putting up flags in the cafeteria of all the countries represented by the student body population. And I remember going to the cafeteria and there being over 60 flags, you know, hanging up on the ceiling.
Annie enjoyed the diversity in her school and neighborhood, but there are also concerns about safety.
I spent time at the mall. I spent time, you know, hanging out at Starbucks and doing kind of just typical kid activities. But there was that kind of undercurrent of, honestly, like violence happening in that suburban community that was always at the back of people's mind. Because I came from the South Asian family where we were kind of expected to keep our heads down, I was sheltered from a lot of that, but I heard a lot about it from my friends at school who were kind of in the middle of it all.
Annie was just a kid when September 11th happened. She was 10 years old. But she noticed a change afterwards.
When it comes to living in Alief, I was one of many Pakistani and South Asian students. After September 11th, there was definitely, even in that community, a shift. I remember students suddenly telling me that their parents didn't want me to talk to them anymore, that their parents had told them, you cannot be friends with Muslim kids anymore. I didn't really say anything and I didn't talk to those students again, but it was just confusing.
Annie enjoyed reading classic dystopian novels like 1984 and Brave New World. In middle school, she started noticing how opportunities were different for her classmates.
When I was in second grade, I was put in the gifted and talented track, and there were Black students or Latina students and Asian students. There weren't a lot of white people that lived in Alief, so there weren't that many of those. But by the time we got to around seventh or eighth grade, I looked around and I realized that almost all the Black and Latino students were gone. There were so many smart kids that I grew up with who ended up dropping out of high school or not getting to college or getting involved with things like dealing drugs or gang violence. When I was in middle school, I got into competitive speech and debate. And it was another glimpse for me that was pretty important around inequality. You would go to these contests and see, you know, wealthy kids from wealthy schools and the amount of support and resources they had. They would get to go to fancy training camps. They would stay at nice hotels. They would have the support of their parents who were volunteers. We were just like a group of very ragtag students in our crew, but we were very focused and determined and had some great coaching from teachers at the school. So we were often quite successful.
Annie's awareness of inequalities sparked an interest in social change.
I grew up feeling very powerless, and I grew up watching a lot of people around me be very powerless because of the circumstances they were in. To hear about some of the home lives of my friends and the experiences they were going through with their families not being safe, as well as the experiences that I was having, was a really big catalyst for wanting to do something positive for the world. My own family experienced their own sorts of instability because we were very poor. We were struggling with our immigration case, and my mom could not work legally growing up. So I remember her taking these kind of under the table jobs at kiosks at the mall or taking care of people's children for a living.
When Annie was in high school, her family's H-1B application was rejected.
There was nothing that we could ever point to and say that this was the reason it was rejected. But we do know that the scrutiny around Muslim men really changed after September 11th. There were many applications that were kind of just arbitrarily denied among South Asian applicants. And I think some of that factored into the ultimate rejection of our H-1B case. But we also had family members who experienced, for example, being put on lists and investigated and things like that.
It's because of 9/11 that we created, you know, the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, departments that to this day are impacting communities in a negative sense. You know, if there is that political will, a lot of things can change in the structure and the systems that we have in our government. There's so much work left to be done in order to address that.
Annie's family decided to apply for asylum.
My parents reassured me that this was just almost like a formality, like it was a done deal. So while I was nervous, I was also relying on them and really, you know, believed them as a child that this would be the way we become citizens and that this limitation that kind of showed up in all sorts of ways in our lives would be lifted. But they did hide the extent of what was going on with our family because, like any parents, they don't want to burden their children with these, you know, difficult facts. When we were preparing for the case, I heard all these stories from both my parents and some other community members who were Ahmadi about the extent of the violence and discrimination that they faced in Pakistan. Some of the stories were pretty jarring, and it was very shocking to hear all of that. It really clicked for me what it meant if we were to be deported and to go back to that country.
The uncertainty her family was facing really took a toll on Annie's emotional well-being.
Honestly, in high school, I became very depressed. I think the stress of it all was pretty significant, but, you know, no one really knew kind of what to do because a kid was stressed out about something like this, and I didn't really know how to put into words what I was experiencing either. But it was pretty detrimental to my mental health to realize what was going on and what were the stakes if this situation didn't go right. My family's community and social life was around the mosque, and no one really talks about challenges that they're facing. So no one was really talking about the challenges that they faced as immigrants, for example, after September 11th. And so while I grew up in this community where all these people you know, had all these things culturally in common and were bonding over religion. I felt at odds because we were going through this very significant experience and it didn't really seem like we were supposed to mention anything. My view of the world, I think, became very small, and I felt very frustrated about that. I was, you know, 16, 17 years old, thinking about my own future and wanting to go to college, wanting to think about what career I could have and what kind of adult I wanted to be. And I felt so stymied. My choices were really limited by how our family's immigration case was playing out. I didn't even know if I could go to college. It felt like everything in my life had kind of come to a little bit of a halt.
I'm just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show.
Annie ended up attending UT Austin after graduating from high school, but her family's immigration challenges became a bit more complicated.
Our asylum case had initially been denied, and even the denial was kind of confounding to a lot of the lawyers that we saw. The success of your case, unfortunately, can depend on something as simple as who your judge is assigned. And so we saw a judge initially that had close to something like 97% rejection rate. When I was a sophomore in college, we were in the appeals process, and I was not really thinking that much about the case. I was trying to enjoy my college experience. And I woke up one morning to a call from my sister. She was hysterical on the phone. ICE had come to our house in Houston and arrested my parents. There was a lawyer who had made a mistake in one of the papers that they had filed in the appeal, and I decided to essentially file deportation proceedings. We didn't know what the mistake was until this all happened, so we didn't have any kind of chance to correct it. My parents were detained and held in a facility for about 3 weeks. Those 3 weeks were pretty much a blur. It was such a traumatic and chaotic situation. All these reassurances that my parents had given me, I realized, were just their best efforts into making us feel better, and they didn't reflect the reality of how the immigration system actually worked. ICE wanted to detain all of us, and they had a warrant for me. I was told by our lawyers not to go to class. When I tried to communicate what I was experiencing and what I was going through to the university administration, they treated it as if it was a criminal matter, and they told me that they would not provide any kind of accommodations because it would be seen as some kind of obstruction of a legal proceeding. Those 3 weeks were just kind of spent in fear. I always call this kind of episode to be like an example of like state-sponsored terrorism. It feels like terrorism, right? To knock on someone's door in the middle of the night and drag away like a mother and a father to a jail cell indefinitely because of a clerical error in some paperwork, and to tell their kids that they want to arrest them too.
Annie's parents were released from detention, but that wasn't the end of their immigration issues.
The MID community really stepped up. They helped my parents find a new lawyer and also helped them put together kind of the resources they needed to start a new legal strategy and to get them out of detention. Our lawyer was someone who's part of the MID community and has done a lot of these kinds of asylum cases. Really, that situation was just the beginning of what would kind of transpire over the next 7 years of fighting this case and having active orders of deportation against us. I was subject to ICE check-ins, which meant that they would call me randomly when I was in class and I would have to step out and answer the call. I remember once missing a call because I was taking a shower, and I just had a total meltdown in my apartment thinking that law enforcement was going to show up guns blazing and drag me out of my house. it was a pretty big strain, and I considered dropping out at several points.
Annie thought about leaving school, but ultimately decided to stay. She was able to find ways to make sense out of her experiences.
I studied political anthropology at UT, which was a major at the time that focused on social movements, on public policy, and on critical race theory. I kind of wanted a why to why my family was experiencing this and why some of my friends were experiencing the things that they had gone through. Going through those studies, especially once my family had deportation proceedings filed against us, was very valuable in helping me make sense of the world. And it was also really helpful in showing me how change has happened historically in this country when it comes to organizing and social movements and influencing policy and government.
Annie also joined an undocumented student group on campus, and she began sharing her story publicly.
You know, the university is not supporting you, and you're fighting this battle largely alone and in isolation. I felt like I was living life behind a glass wall. And so to be able to get together with other people who know exactly what you're going through, and we could have fun with each other in a way that sometimes we couldn't with other people who we'd have to explain these limitations that we were facing in our lives. Ultimately, we played a role in organizing Texas Undocumented Youth to help pass DACA. I had also started to do a lot of work where I would travel the country and share my family story. It was really empowering to work on campaigns and to work with the student group because you were kind of in control of your own destiny instead of waiting for other people to come save you. After I graduated, I joined an organization called Forward US, which is a national immigration reform group. So I threw myself kind of full force into advocating for immigration policies.
Around 2017, Annie's family was granted asylum.
My first reaction was that it was pretty anticlimactic. It feels very strange to have gone through this very traumatizing and egregious experience, all for it to end with someone handing you a piece of paper in a courtroom and saying, you're free to go. For a couple of minutes, my mom, she didn't really believe it. She kept asking, is this it? Is this it? I felt a huge sense of relief and all this excitement immediately afterwards. But ultimately, that excitement gave away to, honestly, to reality, which was just because we got status doesn't mean the challenges ended. We still had a low income. There were all these ways in which we were behind. That includes a lot of things that people probably don't think about. So, for example, if you're someone who didn't have access to healthcare for years, as my family didn't, there's probably all sorts of health issues. Because we got a green card through asylum, there's a lot of different kinds of stipulations. So I still have not gotten to travel outside the country, even though I've had asylum status for about 6 years at this point. And you just kind of get a sense of all those things that you missed out on.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, too. Thanks for listening.
We'll be right back.
This Friday, October 24th, from approximately 10 a.m. until approximately 5 p.m., KPFK Radio 90.7 FM Los Angeles will be off the air.
No! God, please, no! No!
This is to make necessary and long-needed antenna repairs to its Mount Wilson transmitter facilities.
It's time to get busy.
During this time, you can still listen to KPFK online from the KPFK website.
Oh, phew.
Just go to kpfk.org and click Listen Live. It's generous donations like yours that have made it possible for these much-needed repairs to keep KPFK reliably on the air at full power.
You've only begun to discover your power.
Thank you for your patience while we make these essential repairs.
Support comes from the Soraya, presenting Maritza, performing for one night only on November 6th. The acclaimed Portuguese fado singer blends jazz, flamenco, and more into the soulful and poetic nature of traditional Portuguese fado music. Maritza's enchanting charisma and unparalleled voice will take you on a musical journey through the culture and nightlife of Portugal. Further information and tickets are available at thesoraya.org and kpfk.org.
Trago fado no meu canto, canto a noite até ser dia.